This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition global warming is not a crisis. The live event took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of March 14, 2007. It was sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation. The event was moderated by Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show on New York public radio station WNYC. Speaking in favor of the motion were Richard S. Lindzen, the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at MIT, Michael Crichton, a writer and director best known as the author of Jurassic Park and the creator of ER, and Philip Stott, an emeritus professor and biogeographer at the University of London. Against the motion were Richard C.J. Somerville, distinguished professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, University of California, San Diego, Gavin Schmidt, a climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, and Brenda Eckwurzel, who works on the National Climate Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Now, a few words about the format. Each debate consists of an 8-minute opening speech from each panelist, followed by a discussion of questions raised by the audience. The evening concludes with short summary statements from both sides. The audience was polled on the motion, Global Warming is Not a Crisis, before and after the event. The entry poll gauged the live audience as firmly against the motion, with only 30% voting in favor, while 57% were against. 13% didn't know. We'll begin by listening to excerpts of the opening speeches. Richard Lindzen spoke first, and he mentioned a report by the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Here's a sample of his argument.
Please keep in mind what the proposition is. It is not a debate over whether the Earth has been warming over the past century. The Earth is always warming or cooling. And we're talking about, so far, something on the order of 0.6 degrees centigrade. We're not even arguing about whether greenhouse gas emissions are contributing at some level to warming. They most certainly should, though I would suggest it would be very little. Indeed, as far as I can tell, even our opponents do not claim that global warming is a crisis at present. Rather, we are primarily addressing the future. Now, much of the current alarm, I would suggest, is based on ignorance of what is normal for weather and climate. Extreme weather events occur all the time. There is really no evidence of systematic increases, judging from reports from bodies ranging from the National Hurricane Center to the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In fact, outside the tropics, the theory of such storms and variability says that the variability should decrease in a warmer world. And thus, if this is a matter of crisis for where we live, the world is in a permanent state of crisis and will be less prone to crisis in a warmer world. Now, recently, the IPCC Summary for Policymaker came out, and it had an iconic claim about man's impact on temperature change. Does this imply crisis? Modelers use double CO2 as a convenient benchmark, and on the basis of current models, it's claimed that this should lead to about 1.5 to 4.5 degrees warming. What is less often noted is in terms of greenhouse forcing, we're already 3/4 of the way to that doubling. And we've only seen 0.6 degrees. And there's no reason to suppose, furthermore, that this is all due to man. Now, this certainly does not support the model forecasts upon which alarm is based.
The first speaker against the motion was Richard Somerville, who defended the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a group for which he is a contributing author.
Here's a brief look at some of what we know. The IPCC said, quote, warming of the climate system is unequivocal, unquote, based on many kinds of observations. Also, our knowledge of ancient climates tells us that the warmth of the last half century is unusual in at least the previous 1,300 years. The IPCC said most of the observed increase in globally average temperatures in recent decades is very likely due to the observed increase in human-caused greenhouse gas concentrations. These are summary conclusions of experts in a painstaking process lasting years with 30,000 reviewer comments, each logged, numbered, responded to by teams of experts who represent the mainstream science and who take into account views from the fringes as well. There's never been as thorough and vetted a process for summarizing science, precisely for the point of making input to policymakers. Nothing said here tonight, in a few minutes that we have, can possibly undermine this powerful statement from the scientific community. We also project a further warming of a half a degree Fahrenheit for the next 25 years. Beyond that, it does depend largely on how much more CO2 and other greenhouse gases humanity dumps into the atmosphere. Global warming since the 19th century is already more than a degree Fahrenheit. It's continuing. Of the 12 warmest years in the instrumental record, 11 of them have occurred in the most recent 12 years globally. Arctic temperatures in the last 100 years increased twice as much as the global average. Since 1950, the number of heat waves globally has increased. The heat wave in Europe in 2003 that killed more than 30,000 people was unprecedented in modern times. The global ocean, down to a depth of at least 6,000 feet, has been warming since the early 1960s. This warming is contributing to sea level rise. It's by no means all vestiges of the last ice age. Water vapor in the atmosphere, as predicted, is increasing as the world warms. This additional water feeds back. It's a greenhouse gas. It amplifies the warming. It's as though you had your house wired funny so that when it got warm, the thermostat turned on the furnace and made it warmer still. Snow cover and mountain glaciers are decreasing markedly. It's a long list. The list goes on. None of these observational facts is a surprise to the climate science community. They are what we had predicted. We scientists have been expecting measurements like these, and now we see them. The question for the future is simply, how much worse do we intend? How much more severe will we let these trends become? The science warns.
Now, speaking for the motion, Michael Crichton argued that the scientific community could be wrong about global warming, and that given our uncertainty, our resources should be used instead to diminish the problems related to poverty.
I went at a certain point and started looking at the temperature records, and I was very surprised at what I found. The increase in temperature so far over the last 100 years is on the order of 0.6 degrees Celsius, about a degree Fahrenheit. I hadn't really thought, when we talked about global warming, about how much global warming really was taking place. Second thing I discovered was that everything is a concern about the future, and the future is defined by models. But I was interested to see that the models, as far as I could tell, were not really reliable. That is to say, their past estimates have proven incorrect. Well, if this is the situation, I suddenly think about my friends, you know, getting on their private jets, and I think, well, you know, maybe they have the right idea. Maybe all that we have to do is mouth a few platitudes, show a good, you know, expression of concern on our faces, buy a Prius, drive it around for a while and give it to the maid, attend a few fundraisers, and you're done. Because actually, all anybody really wants to do is talk about it. They don't actually do anything. And the evidence for that is the number of major leaders in climate who clearly have no intention of changing their lifestyle, reducing their own consumption, or getting off private jets themselves. If they're not willing to do it, why should anybody else? Is talking enough? I mean, is the talking cure of the environment? Didn't work in psychology, won't work in the environment either. Is that enough to do? I don't think so. I think it's totally inadequate. Every day, 30,000 people on this planet die of the diseases of poverty. There are a third of the planet doesn't have electricity. We have a billion people with no clean water. We have 500 million people going to bed hungry every night. Do we care about this? It seems that we don't. It seems that we would rather look 100 years into the future than pay attention to what's going on now. I think that's unacceptable. And I don't know what's wrong with the rich, self-centered societies that we live in the West, that we are not paying attention to the conditions of the wider world. And it does seem to me that if we use arguments about the environment to turn our back on the sick and the dying of our shared world, and that's our excuse to ignore them, then we have done a true and terrible thing. And it's awful. Thank you.
Speaking against the motion, Gavin Schmidt explained how scientists draw conclusions by judging their level of certainty about facts. He also discussed the intersection where scientific issues meet politics.
Particularly when scientific results are perceived to have economic or moral implications, it's common for political debates to get shifted into the scientific arena. It makes the political argument seem much more scientific and therefore logical. But since the basic disagreement is still political, this is a disaster for any kind of action. Let me give you a few examples of how that works. Creationists have argued that the eye is too complex to have evolved, not because they care about the evolution of eyes, but because they see the implications of evolution as somehow damaging to their worldview. If you demonstrate the evolution of eyes, their worldview won't change. They'll just move on to something else. Another example. When CFCs from aerosol cans and air conditioners were found to be depleting the ozone layer, the CEO of DuPont, the main manufacturer, argued that because CFCs were heavier than air, they couldn't possibly get up to the ozone layer, so there was no need to regulate them. That was pure fantasy, but it sounded scientific. Again, tobacco companies spent millions trying to show that nicotine delayed the onset of Alzheimer's, because that was a distraction from the far more solid case that linked tobacco to lung cancer. That was a distraction and a red herring. These arguments are examples of pseudo-debates, scientific-sounding points that are designed not to fool the experts, but to sow confusion and doubt in the minds of the lay public. This is a deliberate strategy, and you're hearing it here tonight. So during this debate,
these are excerpts from a live IQ Squared US debate. You can listen to the event in its entirety on our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared, and we'll return with more of the opening statements in just 1 minute. We now continue this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate with Philip Stott speaking in favor of the motion, Global Warming is Not a Crisis. He attacked the current scientific consensus on climate change by referring to some press clippings from the 1970s.
Remind us of, because then a crisis was announced. And I want to quote from three newspapers. The Christian Science Monitor. Warning, Earth's climate is changing faster than even experts expect. I really like that. Your own New York Times, a major cooling of the climate is widely inevitable. And Newsweek, back to consensus. Meteorologists are almost unanimous that catastrophic famines will result from global cooling. That was the 1970s, and there are many headlines. And what I would like to stress is, it was a stress on consensus, it was faster than expected. The evidence came from the oceans, from polar bears. It's always polar bears. From the changing seasons, and it's always disaster. Why do we believe them now? Climate always changes. It is always, as Dick said, warming or cooling. It's never stable. And if it were stable, it would actually be interesting scientifically. Because it would be the first time for 4.5 billion years. What is really crucial in all this is something that none of the scientists or none of the politicians want you really to hear. Climate is the most complex system we know, governed by thousands of factors. I haven't time to list them. But the point is, it's like in my country, Glasgow on a Saturday night. Chaos. And what we're trying to do is manage it by dealing with one pub, one inn, and it just won't work. That's the danger. In such a system, doing something at the margins and not doing something in the margins are equally
unpredictable. And the question we should be asking our politicians are, what climate are you actually aiming to produce? And when we get there, won't it change anyway? The crisis is therefore in ourselves. And if we are rejecting this, and I ask you passionately to do so for the next two more important reasons, our political agenda, as Michael hinted, is wrong. There are two great crises in the world, of which the biggest, unquestionably, is 4 billion people in poverty. And this topic is an echocondria of our rich selves, London, New York, and Washington. It's about us and about our hypochondria about the world. If you actually have...
And the last opening statement comes from Brenda Eckwurzel.
Another metaphor that applies is that of a doctor. And studying global warming is like taking the Earth's temperature. We've seen that it's rising, and also we have diagnosed the dominant cause of this fever is the heat-trapping emissions from human activity. So far, temperature's gone up about over a degree, 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit. That doesn't mean much to our everyday lives, but it means everything to the Earth. All of us have experienced 100-degree temperature, 102-degree temperature, but we've survived. Now, the body cannot withstand 107-degree Fahrenheit temperature. That's about an 8-degree jump above the average body temperature. Now, when it comes to the Earth is much more fragile than the body when it comes to temperature. The Earth's fever is only getting worse, and the animals and the plants that are out there struggling are already giving us the early warning signs. Furthermore, there's already heat in the pipeline as the oceans play catch-up to the atmosphere loading that we've put these heat-trapping gases in our atmosphere. Do we really want to lock in even further warming? We're going to keep studying the symptoms as scientists. But the diagnosis is very clear, and the course of treatment is even clearer. Choosing not to fight global warming is as foolhardy as ignoring the early warning signs of a fever of a young child and not attending to that. So what is...
That concludes the opening statement portion of the event. We now begin the question and answer period with a question from the moderator, Brian Lehrer.
Brenda Eckwurzel and Richard Lindzen, can I get the two of you to engage for up to 2 minutes on one thing I noticed in your presentations? Richard Lindzen, you seem to say that warming could make the climate more stable. Brenda, you seem to suggest that it would make it less stable. Richard Lindzen, I'll start with you and talk to each other. Are you arguing that global warming could be good for the Earth?
Of course it could be. That goes without question. There's no reason to assume we're at the optimum for climate.
It's the climate that we have adapted to. It's the climate that has led us to put Battery Park City right at the waterline.
Gavin Schmidt, thank you. Let him. Hang on. Whoa. Let him finish your thought.
What I was referring to was the issue of variability. And that depends basically on the pole to equator temperature difference. And since the models are suggesting that the warming would be greater at the poles, then you are reducing the equator to pole temperature difference, you're decreasing the forcing for storms, and you're decreasing the range.
Brenda Eckwurzel?
Yes, I think the risks are going to grow. We know this with the warming of the planet further. And furthermore, if we have those risks, that means that governments are going to spend much more money, hand over fist, bailing out farmers that are suffering from more extreme drought. We have arable lands growing.
Look, this is less water stress.
And less money for fighting poverty and all those other aspects that are important.
Philip Stott, you wanted to get in here?
Just to say, I did find Gavin's comment a little amusing because, in fact, 8,000 years ago, at a peak of warming, much higher than there. You know what the climate people call it? The climate optimum. In other words, it's actually perceived as more optimal in terms of vegetation and other factors.
Not for people who own basement property in Battery Park City.
A low-lying area of New York City for those of you living around the country.
But I think that raises a really interesting issue because, of course, adaptation to change is always the way that humans have coped with it. In fact, of course, bad planning and bad building doesn't excuse and is not a proof of global warming.
Here's a question for the anti-side. A question for the anti-side, if I might. These 1970s headlines about global cooling, that always comes up as an inconvenient fact. I've almost got a title there. How do you explain that? Who wants it?
There wasn't a scientific consensus in the 70s about global cooling. There was hype in the news media. Quoting Newsweek is not the right way to evaluate scientific thought. You can look it up.
But can I add to that?
Wait, Richard Lindzen, go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, the claim of consensus right now is also not based on a vote or anything else. And, in fact, it was invoked by Newsweek in 1988 when they stated all scientists agreed.
But wait, do you agree on this 1970s global cooling thing, that was media hype, Richard Lindzen?
Actually, I do not disagree with Richard on that.
Right.
So, to the yes team, this debate is set up 3-on-3 as if everything were even. But in the real world out there, we just had the big Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in which 90% of the world's governments declared with 90% certainty that global warming is real and human beings are causing it. Why would you three be more credible to the non-scientists in our audience than all of them?
This is always, to me, a very fascinating point. If we were to say, does the moon revolve around the Earth, we would say yes. And no one would ever preface that by saying, well, the consensus of scientists says this. You know, the notion of consensus is only evoked for very particular kinds of things. And to me, it's a serious warning signal. It's when there isn't a very good and powerful counterargument. That's the first answer. The second answer is one I really like very much, and it's one Einstein made. The Nazis decided that they would do something to demonstrate that German science was bad, and they got 200 German scientists to say that Einstein was wrong, and somebody asked Einstein, how does it feel to have 200 scientists against you? And he said, it takes only one to prove me wrong.
All right, who on the anti-side wants to respond? Gavin Schmidt.
Okay. You frequently stated that consensus is not science. And you know what? I agree with you. Consensus is what's left over after the science has been done. Consensus is what goes into the textbooks. The science is happening at the frontiers. It's the filling in of the interesting pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. It's not the overall picture. The big picture is the stuff that everybody knows and everybody understands.
Michael, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm not saying that the consensus is necessarily wrong. I'm only saying that consensus is not a clear proof that it's right.
And moreover, Michael has made a point.
Richard Lindzen on the same side. Continue.
Le Monde made the same statement. You don't use consensus if you have a proof.
What's very important...
Philip Stott, you want to back that up further?
Yeah, Gavin rightly said we should always be at the edge. The edge of science on climate change has nothing to do with CO2. It's to do with what we call cosmic rays, their relationship to the sun, and water vapor.
Anybody else on the anti-side want to come back on that? They all three got a lick in there. Richard Somerville?
That is mind-boggling. To say that cosmic rays are the cause of climate change is to endorse one of the least proven, most tentative...
I didn't say that.
Oh, good.
Well, then why did you bring it up?
Why did you bring it up?
Simply because there are a whole range of scientists who are working on this particular topic, and they say it's one of the big unknowns, and a great deal of research has just been done on it.
We're talking about global warming. We're talking about the trend in temperature that we've seen over the last 30 years. There has been no trend in cosmic rays. So any change that there might have been because of cosmic ray impacts on climate can't possibly have an impact on what's been going on in the last changes.
But the most famous astrophysicist working on it say there has.
He is wrong.
Okay.
Sorry.
We're now ready to vote. No, I'm kidding.
Quite serious.
There are some very eminent scientists, Professor Jan Weser, for example, who are in fact arguing that 70% of climate change is primarily driven by cosmic rays working through water vapor and clouds. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. They're pointing, however, at the edge to new research. You cannot dismiss that because it's a consensus for CO2.
Gavin Schmidt, one more time.
Okay, this is exactly what I was talking about. You see, now it looks like we're having a scientific argument, but this is completely bogus. You don't know that it's bogus. But I know that it's bogus. He knows that it's bogus. You're being led astray.
You'll forgive me, Gavin. If you seriously wish to maintain that, then you better explain
Richard
why
Linson.
Between you and Richard, you've made statements that are overtly untrue. And I'll give you some. You said the Earth has been warmer, is warmer now than it has been for 1,300 years. The National Academy evaluating this said the methodology was no use beyond 400 years.
The National Academy of Science report said that we have good evidence that we're warmer from 400 years ago. We have credible evidence that we're warmer from 900 years.
No, they did not.
Yes, they did, Richard. Please read
the
reports.
The front end said...
Read more than the front page, Richard.
No, I'm saying the text said it was not credible beyond 400 years.
We're into he said, but... But Gavin Schmidt, you seem to suggest that the other side does not have a real scientific argument, but a culturally or politically constructed one. You don't think they're sincere?
That's a very difficult question. I do think that they're sincere.
You as much as said it.
I don't think that they are completely doing this on a level playing field that the people here will understand. And there are... Well,
Let me explain. Because they have larger cultural or political agendas?
No, I have no idea what their political or cultural agendas are. And to be frank, I'm not very interested.
I'm left-wing and have no money whatsoever from any oil company, I wouldn't.
That's fine.
But I'm conservative and have no money.
I'm not interested in your motivation.
But I know Gavin has interests.
Let's go to the audience. Down on this side in the front.
Andy Revkin from the New York Times. This is kind of neat to listen to. My sense is that there's one thing that everyone has agreed on, at least except maybe Philip, which is that more greenhouse gases will make the world warmer. Is there anyone other than Philip who disagrees with that?
I don't disagree with that.
So everyone agrees more greenhouse gases will make the world warmer. The doubling is a step on the staircase we're heading on toward tripling or quadrupling. I think everyone would mostly agree that if we go to 9 billion people, all of whom would love to have our level of affluence, we're going in that direction. And so as a hedging exercise, if it weren't costly to slow the pace, would anyone on the pro side think that it's a bad idea to stop emitting greenhouse gases if there were a solution?
Michael Crichton, you're shaking your head no.
No,
as a hedge.
No, I don't think anybody objects. The question is whether or not you're going to spend what Bjorn Lomborg thinks, which is $558 trillion. And I think if, in fact, it's going to prove to be that kind of enormous construction project, then that should not be the first priority right this minute. But no, I don't.
So let me pursue Andy Revkin's stab at striking a consensus on what to do. For the anti-side, if this is a crisis, what kind of lifestyle change, what kind of economic pain, and how quickly are you proposing to hedge our bets?
ASAP.
Brenda Eckwurzel.
As soon as possible, because...
But what?
Everything. Everything that we can throw at solving this climate crisis, well, this climate problem, is important because... Every day that we emit carbon dioxide means that it will last for many, many centuries. And so we have to start weaning ourselves off of ways of emitting more methane, more nitrous oxide, all the heat-trapping gases, not just carbon dioxide. It's the ones that have long life, nitrous oxide, carbon dioxide, that are very, very important. In the short term, methane is very important because it has such heat-trapping potential.
But
and so landfills, everything.
The question from the audience was... Things that we can do without much pain that would stave this off. You're talking about revolution, anything necessary.
The real problem is social discounting in this. Let's get a bit of economics in. So, in fact, if you have an increase now and you take inflation into account, what you're doing is an average world income at the moment of $7,500. predicted by a distance ahead, that will rise to about $88,000. You knock off what, in fact, the Stern report in Britain estimated as, in fact, the cost of global warming, 13.27 or so percent. It comes down to something like 70-something thousand dollars. But even taking inflation account, that is still a massive increase in wealth. So what you're actually asking in economic terms is what is strange, but a poorer generation to sacrifice a great deal for what will, in any case, even with global warming, if it occurs, be a wealthier generation.
The thing is that companies right now, when they reduce heat-trapping emissions, they find profits that keep giving back to them, because right now we're so wealthy in many nations of the world that we are wasting energy because we can afford to. And the reality is many companies are saving lots of money when they make small investments to reduce their emissions. DuPont did $50 million to invest. They're getting $2 billion on return on that investment, and it keeps on giving. So it's not an economic argument.
Anything else from the anti-side that you think might be the consensus, good for us anyway kind of measures that they might agree to?
Right. Energy conservation.
Gavin Schmidt.
Everybody is going to agree that energy conservation is a good thing, and it should be encouraged. Right.
Yes? Three heads nodding on this side?
Yeah. I mean, you're going to argue with energy conservation?
All right. Two and a half. Two and a half heads. That's good enough. Go on. Richard Somerville.
You know, a lot of things could be done. Once you free up the creativity of technical people, of business people, by making this a priority nationally and internationally. The problem isn't that there's nothing that can be done. The problem is that the people who are asking for your vote haven't heard loudly enough that this is an important issue to the electorate. So it's way down on people's priorities. That's the reason for the lip service that Michael Crichton talked about. People are a lot like Mark Twain. They're all for progress but opposed to change.
Let's go back to the audience.
You're listening to a debate on the proposition global warming is not a crisis. We'll return with more questions from the audience, followed by panelists' closing statements and results of the audience poll in just 1 minute. I'm Robert Siegel with Intelligence Squared U.S., and we'll now rejoin the debate with another question from the audience.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Heather Higgins. I'm not a scientist, so pardon my ignorance. When I hear the scientific establishment believes in something, I immediately think of flat Earth consensus and the fact that there's no geography that should be admitted as science and that women are all hysterics and ought to be bled. Cool. That assurance that the scientific community believes something does not take me very far. My question is addressed particularly to Brenda as well as to anyone else. I was fascinated by your statement that the Earth is more fragile than human beings are. I am not a scientist, so maybe you can explain to me how we managed to get through the Ice Age and the Middle Ages when Greenland was actually green and people were a foot taller and there was farming there and nobody was digging up coal to warm the Earth. And I'm curious as to why you think that this is an optimal period of climate. Certainly for far less money, we could move everybody out of Battery Park City. And I am curious if you believe that CO2 is actually the particulate problem is actually the issue, the degree to which you are willing to become like France, where instead of having 20% of their power from nuclear, they have 86%.
When there was a natural ice age before and when we were coming out of that ice age, there weren't millions of people, 80% of our population, living on the coast with their high-dollar homes or maybe fragile homes, not such high-dollar homes. There are many people living in Bangladesh that are squeezed between sea level rise and the melting of the Himalayas and flooding from the land side. And so we are talking about the fragility of humans adapting to this rapid change, as well as when in the past, sea level rise, you could have, for example, wetlands marching up onto land and moving inland and adapting, and dunes moving inland. Right now, we have all our infrastructure in its place, and you can see Miami is stranded out there. Atlantic City is stranded out there. We spend many of millions of dollars dredging and keeping these unsustainable systems. They're not able to adapt naturally anymore because we're in the way. And we also are going to suffer if we don't make action.
Philip Stott, you get 20 seconds to respond.
It was, I think, a brilliant question, that, because the Earth is as tough as an old boot. If there is any fragility, it's in us, and that's what we're concerned about. The Earth will survive whether we're here or not, whether there's global warming or not.
Question on this side.
Hi, Van Greenfield. Just following up a little bit on the question 2 minutes ago on what we could do. Philip, you had said in another article, my own instinct is that our ability to change reflectivity on the Earth's surface will in the end prove to have been far more important. In terms of the concept of reflectivity, could you expand on that and its possible less expensive method for dealing with this?
Very briefly, please.
Very briefly, but it's a very important point. The point is very simple, that humans are not just doing CO2. We do many factors. And the way we have altered the albedo, as we call it, the surface reflectivity of the Earth, particularly, I may add, since the Neolithic Revolution in agriculture, has had probably quite a significant effect. However, we can't model it very well. And the problem is it's one of those big gaps, like many other things, in the models that we're talking about. And that is a human factor. So in other words, I agree with that. Exactly how we cope with it, though, is another issue, because in fact we know so little about it. And can I remind everybody that IPCC that we keep talking about very honestly admits that we know very little about 80% of the factors behind climate change.
One more thing for the anti-side. Okay, go ahead and give a quick response to that. 20-second response.
What does 80% of the climate factors even mean? If you look at the radiative forcing from carbon dioxide, from methane, from nitrous oxides, from CFCs, from tropospheric ozone, from stratospheric ozone, from land use change, from aerosols, from black soot's impact on snow albedo, you know, all of those things, we know some of them very well, we know some of them less well. But to claim that we don't know anything about 80% of them is a meaningless statistic.
Yeah, I'd like to. Could I chime in there just for a moment,
Richard Somervin? Also, 20 seconds.
Listen, it's fun to hear other people practicing meteorology without a license. So, you know, this field is like all fields of science. You know, medical science is incomplete and has uncertainties too. But it's good enough to be useful. You don't dismiss your doctor's advice because she hasn't solved all the diseases. And I think the same is true of climate science today. Don't dismiss it.
Well, let's use an engineer. I don't think I'd want to cross Brooklyn Bridge if it had built by an engineer who only understood 80% of the forces on that bridge.
There's one thing that I think we need to get to before we wrap up. For the anti-side, they say the real crises today include poverty, dirty water, and a lack of modern energy supply to 4 billion poor people on Earth. So if this is a crisis, how do you prioritize it compared to those other things, and assuming that it takes tremendous amounts of resources to solve any of them?
You know, I cannot imagine why Philip Stott and Michael Crichton seem to think that doing something about these terrible crises is impossible if you do something about climate change, or even made more difficult. Climate change need not be in competition with or be an alternative to do something about the terrible toll that poverty and preventable disease take. We can do both of those and many other worthy things as well. In fact, it's exactly the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet who will suffer the most from the consequences of global warming, which goes on unabated.
Michael Crichton?
You know, I'm really fascinated at the number of newspaper headlines and articles that I see about global poverty and the difficulties of people in Africa as compared to the headlines about global warming. And of course, Richard, it's very true that we can do two things at the same time. The reality is that we don't. And the reality is that we are failing and have continuously failed to address the issues of the third world, even though everyone knows that if you were to look at it for bangs for the buck, if you were to look at it from a humanitarian standpoint, if you were to look at it from the easiest way to do the most for environmental degradation that's occurring around the world, you would address global poverty. But we're not. We're talking as we're talking tonight. We're all getting very heated about something that may or may not happen 100 years from now. And while we're doing it, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 people are dead.
That concludes the question and answer period of the debate. Next, we'll hear the closing statements presented in their entirety, with Richard Somervin speaking against the motion, global warming is not a crisis.
You know, the fossil fuel age will surely end, sooner rather than later, I hope, if we're wise. Sheikh Yamani, the Saudi oil minister, was fond of saying the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones. And continuing to generate 80% of the world's energy from fossil fuel and using the atmosphere as a free dump for waste products will ultimately produce a damaged planet. We've heard a lot of chatter about decarbonization this evening. The fact is that carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. and globally are going up, not down. Sherwood Rowland, later a Nobel laureate, was a frustrated person in 1984 because humanity was so slow in dealing with the issue of ozone depletion. He said, quote, "After all, what's the use of having developed a science well enough to make predictions if in the end all we're willing to do is stand around and wait for them to come true?" Rowland's remark is apt for our topic tonight. As in the case of ozone loss, so with global warming, once again, powerful technology, in this case abundant, cheap fossil fuel energy, with unanticipated side effects, has brought us a Faustian bargain. Once again, the world finds itself at a point where difficult decisions must be made. That's the definition of a crisis, nothing to do with alarmism or catastrophe. Once again, doing nothing or too little will lead to dire consequences. Belittling the science, attacking the scientists, impugning their integrity and competence and motivations, refusing to recognize what we have learned about climate change in the vain and naive hope that the problem will somehow solve itself is irresponsible. Action is needed, meaningful action, soon. Global warming is a crisis. Thank you. I hope you voted against.
Philip Stott, your closing statement.
May I say that the last thing I want to do is to demean any scientist. The whole point about science is that it is a constant debate. And actually, what has worried me deeply about this is not the demeaning of scientists, but the attempt to close down the debate and actually take it away from science. If I may use a musical analogy, my other great interest, trying to reconstruct the climates at the moment, as we're talking about, is a bit like trying to play Mozart's wonderful Sinfonia Concertante, case 364, when you've no viola part and only a quarter of the violin part. In other words, we know remarkably little about so much of the climate that we are facing. And what I would like to stress is it's a debate on the crisis. We've mentioned the crisis of poverty, and I think the crisis of hypocrisy. Actually, where I think we probably agree entirely as a panel, what there really is in the world is not a crisis of climate, a crisis of energy. That is certainly true in my country. And I'll tell you what worries me particularly about attaching it to climate. In the world, there are groups, including some very reputable groups in Denmark and in Russia and other countries, which are predicting, actually, that we will enter a global cooling phase between 2012 and 2015. Now, I no more necessarily believe that than I do about the global warming, but just supposing that happens, and just supposing what the public reaction is to the hype that there has been about global warming, I actually think that we have to face up to a genuine energy issue in the world, and that most of our politicians are not doing that. In fact, they're dressing it up in this idea of global warming and saving the world. And what we desperately need are very practical decisions about energy on the ground. And I think the idea of using the climate to do this is potentially a very dangerous one. So what I am worried about is that everybody is now using the global warming construction for their own agendas, from capitalist carbon trading right the way to making you wear hemp underpants. I distrust that because in the end,
Stott,
it's an ism, and I distrust isms.
Gavin Schmidt, your closing statement.
Hemp underpants? Climate change is not a new issue. Even human-caused climate change is not new. Richard Lindzen was arguing these same points 15 years ago. Michael Crichton is recycling talking points that are decades old. Philip Stott is grasping at extremely flimsy straws. Serious scientists in the 1960s made predictions for what would be found if human emissions of greenhouse gases were to continue. They said the planet would warm. It has. They said that water vapor measurements would show rises. They do. They said that ocean heat content would rise. It has. They said the stratosphere would cool. It did. If I had time, I could go on listing the number of challenges this basic idea has faced and come through. But you only need to know that it is still standing and that there are no coherent theories that fit the observations better. Given that understanding and the ever-increasing emissions that we are putting into the air, to deny this is a crisis on a planetary scale is truly to fiddle while home burns.
That's it. Richard Lindzen, your closing statement.
Yes, I think it's a little bit difficult to know how to respond, to be told that one shouldn't attack scientists while you're attacking scientists. to go and say you have to control methane without explaining that methane has stopped growing. You don't explain why there's global warming on Mars, Jupiter, Triton, and Pluto. You don't look at the ocean data and see that whereas your boss, Jim Hansen, was saying that the heating of the ocean proved the flux that he needed for high sensitivity, that in the last year there have been two papers in the same journal that point out that the original Levitas data is wrong, that the ocean is cooled, and that the new numbers would call for one-tenth the sensitivity that Hansen mentioned. If all this is so certain, why is the data changing? Or is it a case when the data changes, you ignore it and stick to the point?
You have a minute. Do you want the other minute? You have a minute? No? Okay. Brenda Eckwurzel, your closing statement.
Global warming is here today and is accelerating. Many business leaders are already realizing that it makes economic sense to start fighting global warming. Walmart, DuPont, BP, General Electric, they all are asking for action. And businesses need a clear signal from the national level because they want to have a level playing field and they want to plan for the future. And that's what makes good business sense. We need a national policy because people, cities, and states cannot reduce global warming enough to make a significant dent in this issue. Ultimately, the atmosphere is going to register all of our choices from today onward. We must act now because if we leave it to our children, the risk will be too great and it will be too late. Fortunately, there already exist solutions. All we need now is the will to implement them rapidly. Thank you.
Michael Crichton, your closing statement.
There was a time when I worked in a clinic, and one day a young woman came in. She was in her early 20s for a routine checkup, and I said, "What's going on with you?" And she said, "I've just become blind." And I said, "Oh, my gosh, really, when did it happen?" She said, "Well, just coming to the clinic, walking up the steps of the clinic, I became blind." And I said, "Oh," and by now I'm looking through the chart, and I said, "Well, has this happened before?" She said, "Yes, it's happened before. I've become blind in the past." And what she had, of course, was hysterical blindness. And the characteristic of that is that the severity of the symptom is not matched by the emotional response that's being presented. Most people would be screaming about that, but she was very calm. "Oh, yes, I'm blind again." And I'm reminded of that whenever I hear that we're facing, whether we want to call it a crisis or not, a significant global event of importance where we're going to have species loss and so on and so forth, but that we can really address this by changing our light bulbs, or that we can really make an impact by unplugging our appliances when we're not using them. It's very much out of whack. And so if it were going to only do symbolic actions, I would like to suggest a few symbolic actions that might really mean something. One of them, which is very simple, 99% of the American population doesn't care, is ban private jets. Nobody needs to fly in them. Ban them now. And in addition, let's have the NRDC, the Sierra Club, and Greenpeace make it a rule that all of their members cannot fly on private jets. They must get their houses off the grid. They must live in the way that they're telling everyone else to live. And if they won't do that, why should we? And why should we take them seriously?
And that concludes our debate. Here's moderator Brian Lehrer.
And now the results of our debate. After our debaters did their best to sway you, you went from 30% for the motion that global warming is not a crisis, from 30% to 46%. Against the motion went from 57% to 42%, and undecided went from 13% to 12%. The hardcore ambivalent are still among us. So, in terms of opinion change, those in favor of the motion have carried the day. Congratulations to the team for the motion.
You can hear this program and other debates in the Intelligence Squared series or subscribe to our podcast at npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC New York Public Radio, producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore, Marlon Barry, and Edward Haber, production assistants from Scott Goldberg. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.